It's Mame Warren. Today is the 19th of April, 1996. I'm in New York City, and I'm interviewing Tom Wolfe.
I did a little cheating and listened to the talk that you gave at Lee Chapel a few years ago, which was absolutely delightful. I was walking around my field listening to it and laughing, having a delightful time. My neighbors thought I was crazy. But one of the things that you said was that the only other place you applied was Princeton.
That's true.
And I was at Princeton on Wednesday, and so I'm really intrigued by that those were your two choices.
Well, first you have to understand that this was 1947. In 1947, if you had the tuition and you could make a breath fog on a mirror, you could get into any college in America. It was not a big deal. And I didn't even think about where I was going to go to college until probably May of, maybe it was a little earlier than that, not much, of my senior year. And so I applied. I'd heard of Princeton. Didn't seem too far away. I had a good reputation. I really knew almost nothing about Washington and Lee, except people spoke highly of it. And so I just applied to these two places. I was accepted at both. I visited both with my parents. And we just found Washington Lee a lot more attractive. It was warmer, I mean, in terms of congeniality. It was convenient, and so we chose Washington and Lee. I mean, the atmosphere of choosing a college, I mean, there were no SATs existed, but you didn't have to take them, and I never took them for either place. I think we must have had some kind of test, but it's just, you know, I have a daughter who's now a sophomore in high school, and already thoughts turn towards the college scramble. And of course, your senior year means nothing now. It all has to be done. It's just a madhouse now. But it was anyway. It was just seemed more attractive than Princeton, and so I went to Washington Lee.
Well, my first hour on Wednesday, I was very impressed, and as the day wore on, I was very glad I was going to be going home to Lexington. It was overwhelming.
Well, Princeton is a very nice. I've gotten to know a lot more about Princeton since then. Talk about a place that's overgrown now. The university has made that area so attractive that it's this kind of dreadful corridor of new businesses and just. It's getting swamped. Anyway, that's off the subject.
So you came in 1947.
Yes.
So you arrived with James Layburn.
That's right.
Were you aware that that was a real shift at Washington and Lee?
Yes, because he was so, not that I understood such things, but he was so remarkable that you caught it immediately. For one thing, he lived right there on the campus in a house. I don't know what that house is used for now. But it was right 35 feet from Washington Hall, I guess. And in the evenings, he would play the piano. He was a wonderful piano player, and he was playing, Chopin, Debussy, Bach, Brahms, and Mozart. It lent a real atmosphere to life on the campus, just to see him. He was a very erect, good-looking man, terrific posture, and great confidence, and a marvelous manner. And he was one of those people who had real intellectual charisma.
Tell me what you mean by that.
You you immediately realized this was a serious man with whom you took no liberties. And yet he was not a distant man. He wasn't remote. He wasn't at all pompous. Quite the contrary. He was a gentleman with a great aura of learning and cultivation. And I don't know why even somebody like myself just popping in from high school would pick this up, but you did. Everyone did immediately. He also had great ideas that I always wished Washington and Lee. Well, they followed many of his ideas, but there were other things I wish had been, suggestions of his I wish had been carried through. One was, he wanted there to be a Washington Lee blazer, which would have a crest and that students would wear that in academic robes. I think it was another idea he had of that you might, instead of just getting academic robes to graduate in, have them to wear every day. And why not? What a marvelous idea. I think it's great. I mean, one of the bad changes at Washington Lee since I was there was getting rid of conventional dress. When I was there, I rebelled against it in a modest way. I wore the reverse of the expected tonal combinations. I found a place in Richmond called the National Shirt Shop, which was frequented by people who like to go to the races, as far as I could tell. and they had maroon, navy, and black shirts, but conventionally cut, as in conventional dress. And when you combine those with pale gray jackets, was what I like, you know, almost white, chalky gray jackets and so on, you could get some rather striking and white necktie with a black or navy shirt. This was modest rebellion against conventional dress. Everything was conventionally cut, so there was nothing anybody could really do about it. Well, but the longer I stayed, the more I realized that there's something very important about conventional dress. I mean this seriously. It's a constant reminder that you're something special, that you're maintaining standards that other of your contemporaries and are not maintaining, and that something more is expected, and that you expect more of other people. Now, after all, formal dress, and of course now conventional dress looks like something very formal. Formal dress is a signal to other people that you expect to be treated in a certain way, in a certain way that maintains your superiority. And I think there's nothing at all wrong with having young people feel superior, since they will work so hard to show that they don't feel it, even if they do. And thank God Washington Lee campus is not as bedraggled looking as many others, but when I see the favored sons and daughters of America dressed in rags on college campuses all across the country, I think it's ridiculous, and I also think it's really unwise to encourage it. And most campuses really they encourage it. That may not seem like, and to most people it seems like a very petty thing. I don't think it is, and I think it's a real mistake to let that die out. But it'll never come back. I mean, not for a long, long time, anyway.
Well, it hasn't died out completely at Washington and Lee. At mock convention, my husband was astonished at how many blue blazers. He said, "Do they wear uniforms here?" There are many, many, many blue blazers at Washington and Lee.
Well, I think it is a better looking campus by far than most in terms of dress. But people don't understand how important symbolism is in upholding standards of all kinds.
Well, Washington and Lee has a I think, a stronger sense than most of that idea of symbolism and tradition.
Oh, yes. That's certainly true. And probably should be. I was kind of the campus liberal, I guess, when I was there, because everyone seemed so conservative. Maybe that's a contrary streak in me, and I was. Whenever it came time for election years, students to, and just in conversation, divide up on political lines, I was always the Democrat, and much more interested in things like radicalism and literature and so on. When I got to Yale, and the conformity was entirely the opposite direction, Yale graduate school, not the undergraduate, and the conformity was entirely the opposite direction, I found myself suddenly the conservative. I arrived being an Adlai Stevenson adherent, and left an Eisenhower proponent. But that says a lot more about me than either institution. But no, Washington Lee does have its has maintained a lot of its traditions.
Can we talk about some of those things, like, in particular, the honor system? Was that strongly put forth to you when you first arrived?
It was, but I had also been to a high school, St. Christopher's in Richmond, which had an honor system. And so I didn't think that much about it. I just thought that's the way schools were run. As you can tell, I wasn't particularly aware of very much of other schools, and it did really seem to work. I mean, it was, and I didn't realize how unusual that was till I went to other places. And when I went to Yale as a graduate student, I would serve sometimes as a proctor in examinations and so on. Just the idea of having a proctor in examinations, I found rather startling. And the students were always separated at one desk was always one empty desk in between two students taking a test. The assumption being that they're going to cheat if you didn't separate them, you didn't have somebody looking all the time. And I don't know what it's like now, but in Lexington, when I was at Washington and Lee, the honor system was so strong that all merchants gave you credit. There was no such thing as a charge account, and there was no such thing as playing cash unless you wanted to. You could just go in and anywhere and charge anything you wanted. Certainly no questions about a check. You just go in and charge. And so when I went off to Yale, I had a dorm room which you had to furnish yourself in terms of, if you wanted something like a rug. And so I just walked, I never will forget this, it was in September of 47, of 51, after I graduated from W&L. I walked from the Yale campus down to one of the big department stores in New Haven, and I went to the rug department, and I picked out a rug, and they said, "Do you have a charge account?" And I assumed this. Do you have an account with? And I said, and I assumed this meant, were you at the were you at Yale? Yeah. And so I gave them my name and address. And in those days, there were no credit cards anyway. I gave them my name and address and put the rug over my shoulder. It was a sisal rug, I remember, and walked back up the hill to to Yale, and then I got it in the room, and it was the wrong size. And so I put it over my shoulder, and I walked back. And when I walked back into the, this was about 3 hours later, you know, 4 hours later, and I walked back into the rug department, and three people ran up to me, and with a furious look on their faces, like, and I think they were ready, they were on the point of putting me under arrest, so they just discovered I had no charge account at this department store, you know. But I just assumed that's the way the world was.
Well, that was the beginning of your Yale education, I guess.
Well, we call it the world education.
So you arrived in 1947. Mm-hmm. I presume there would have been a lot of veterans on campus at that time.
Yes, and I really came to hate veterans. That war was so different from all the wars since then, all of which have been unpopular. And it's hard for anybody whose first experience of war at home was Vietnam or Korea or any of the engagements since to realize how popular the Second World War was. It's enormously popular. You know, politicians in 1945 were leaping into the service just to have it on their record that they had been in the armed services. And veterans, returning veterans, were considered as demigods. They were warriors who had fought a great, magnificent fight, not only to save America, but to save civilization. And they were considered really superior beings. And I really got a snoot full of this very quickly. I mean, could you tell at a glance, it was really nothing very special about it. They didn't know that. And they instituted something called Bulge Day, which every non-veteran came to hate rapidly. One of the great battles of the Second World War was the Battle of the Bulge. And there were tremendous casualties. Our troops persevered and won this great battle. And you can understand why to people who had actually fought there or been over there, this was like the Battle of Cold Harbor or the Battle of Bull Run or Manassas. And so they would make all of the pledges in the fraternities. And as you know, at Washington Lee, practically everybody ends up in a, then as now, about 80% were in fraternities. All the pledges in the fraternities would have to line up with wooden paddles over their shoulders, executing military maneuvers while the upperclassmen got drunk and sobbed uncontrollably at memories of their days on the battlefield, if any. No, the veterans had great status, very high status. It's hard, it really is very hard to realize just how terrific they seem, particularly if you're in light of what the terrible reception that veterans got after the war in Vietnam.
So had things settled down by the time you arrived and people were clearly in defined classes? Because my sense of, I've talked to a couple of people whose mm-hmm. careers at WNO were interrupted by the war, and it seems like it got very confusing about what class you were in then.
It wasn't to me, but I suppose it was to them. Mm-hmm. I remember I would say yes sir to a lot of these people. They were older. And if you grew up in Richmond, and at least in the sort of circles I was in, you sirred and ma'am people to death. That was just kind of drummed in. That was the way you were brought up. And I remember a number of them would get annoyed at being called sir. They didn't want to really feel that old and distinguished. But I don't remember any particular, because as far as I was concerned, it wasn't very confusing. But, I knew what class I was in. And now that was a problem, though, is knowing, the biggest problem with knowing what about classes were the people really did not have class affiliations. They had fraternity affiliations.
Were you in a fraternity?
I was in a fraternity called Phi Kappa Sigma. And I remember Dean Gillum, about whom you've no doubt heard a great deal.
No, actually, I no? haven't heard. He's alluded to, but I would love it if you would talk about him.
Well, he was probably the greatest admissions magnate, and he was in charge of admissions, but he was dean of the whole shooting match. He was always the number two man under the president, but he was in charge of admissions, and was a great salesman for Washington and Lee, or for anything else, because he was the consummate Southern aristocrat. Had a magnificent house just up that hill what do they call it? I don't know what they call it. It's you know where those, like it's tennis courts? Some kind of sports.
Oh, up behind Wilson Field? Up that
yes,
way?
Yes. Up that way, up on that hill.
Yes.
He had a magnificent home, stone home, called Bell something, Bell.
Stono, wasn't it Stono?
No, it was, I think it was just on the market recently. I don't know who owns it now.
That's why I'm aware of it.
Bell something. Seems to me it was Bell.
Oh, yes, you're right. It has great gardens.
No doubt it does. But yes. There's quite a few homes up there, all very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But this was really something. And he was also a great speaker. But he was a remarkable figure. And a singular figure, sort of the way Dean Laban was. And he would give a talk each fall in Lee Chapel to the incoming freshmen. And he would say, Rush Week was the first week of school, which I consider to be a dreadful custom. But anyway, I was going to get off on that. A custom you can't kill with a stick for some reason. But anyway, the rush week is the first week of school. And here you are coming into this new place, and immediately you're made to feel that if you don't get in a fraternity that week, you're life at Washington and Lee is over. You're part of a doomed species. And he would give this talk saying, don't think of it that way. He'd say, two years after you've left college, you'll realize it doesn't matter whether you were in one of these fraternities or not, won't make the slightest difference. Just don't get carried away by it. Well, of course, no one could believe that he was meant it or that he was right. Of course, he was absolutely right. And to this day, I don't know why Washington and Lee or any other college would put up with national fraternities. I mean, it's the silliest anachronism on the face of the earth. Nobody from your fraternity that you're going to run into outside of the campus that you're on cares for 2 seconds that you were a member of their fraternity, you know, Phi Kappa Sigma in another place. And God forbid if you actually turn up at their fraternity house expecting some hospitality. They really wish you would crawl off and drop through a crack in the sidewalk. But that was, nevertheless, that was the fraternity system was very strong. And, you know, once I was in a fraternity, I must confess I enjoyed it. And you had a, you had a home. You had a constant source of camaraderie. You had, and I suppose in the way it's the way life is too. You people are do split up into fraternities, even if they aren't called that. So I suppose it's in some way a microcosm of what's going to happen to you when you leave. But I didn't know what one fraternity from another, but there were a lot of Richmond people in this fraternity I joined, and I knew them, they knew me, and it seemed so important to get into something.
Is that how it broke down? You went with people who were like you? Is that how people made their decision?
I mean, I tell you, at the time it seemed so important, and that I just went with people who knew me. You know, I knew them, they knew me, and as far as I knew, nobody else was going to choose me anyway. I mean, why should they? They didn't know me. Here was this life buoy floating on the water, so I grabbed it.
So once you joined the fraternity, did you then take your meals there?
Yes, well, because that was where most of the dining facilities were, practically all. There was no university dining hall at that time. That's a wonderful thing that's happened since then, is that there is a university dining hall, and you don't have to depend on fraternities for as eating clubs. But that's where, and see, students at, as I recall anyway, at that time really didn't have the kind of pocket money that they seem to have now. Mm-hmm. And to eat a meal out was a big thing, at least it was on my budget, and I think most people's. And it was unusual to have an automobile. Some did, I mean, and they were considered extremely wealthy. Now I gather all over the place, but not then. Which I also think is probably a good thing, not to have the cars. But I do remember that suddenly you had this fraternity fever as soon as you arrived. But as I say, I enjoyed it. I lived in a fraternity house for 3 years, which is very unlike me. I mean, I don't like a lot of noise and turmoil. I hate drinking to this day. I was a teetotaler.
Well, now that's a hard thing to do at Washington.
Washington and Leland, and I was considered a very strange person. Well, there were several reasons I was considered a very strange person. One was I wore a hat. That would be strange today, it was strange then. And a fedora. And I often carried an umbrella, even on sunny days. Which I didn't consider so. It was nice to have something to hold. I always have thought hats looked great. And I wear them now. And I like to watch the old Untouchables movies because every man when he leaves a building has a hat on in the Untouchables movies. I mean, that was very typical of the 30s. But I think I was considered strangest of all for the fact that I did not drink. And I just think drink is appalling. anything beyond a glass of wine. Nothing wrong with a glass of wine.
So was that... Because obviously I wasn't there at that time period, but the consumption of alcohol seems to be an important thing in the whole experience of Washington and Lee.
Well, I'll tell you, it was an important thing in the... throughout Southern universities. It wasn't just Washington and Lee. I mean, the University of Virginia was made people at Washington and Lee look like white ribbon wearers. And the same, and my sister has just done the research for a documentary on University of North Carolina, for which has appeared, I think, on some of the PBS channels. And she discovered, going back into the 19th century, I think it was on the occasion of the 200th anniversary of University of North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
She discovered that the drinking was, you know, worse back in the middle of the 19th century than now. So, I mean, it's an old tradition. Scott, so as if, you know, one of the ways you show that you are now a grown-up, independent young man, because all these places were all male. Was to drink, and to drink a lot. Of course, all it really shows is you've got the instincts of a 7-year-old. but that's just me talking, you know. I mean, this is.
Well, I think I'm more in agreement with you than I am with him. I've always been kind of appalled by it myself.
And it's a terrible problem at universities everywhere in this country right now. And a lot of these children, and they are children, you know. Childhood ends about age 29, you know. That's the truth. I mean, I've never seen, probably never been a period in all of history in which adolescence has been so extended. And it's because of so much money. You know, you can't extend adolescence if there isn't a lot of fat in an economy. But now, why did I even get into that? I don't know. Go ahead.
Let's go back into the classroom. Tell me about teachers who made a difference for you.
Well, the great thing about Washington and Lee, and it's one of the things that will make Washington and Lee increasingly attractive, I predict, over the next 25 years, if not longer, is that you are and always have been, at least since I was there, in very close touch with the teachers. There were no teaching assistants. There were no graduate students teaching you. You didn't have a lecture hall of where 400 students took a course and then broke up into seminars run by graduate students who were 2 weeks ahead of you in the syllabus, if that. And that was a wonderful experience to have. You could always ask questions in the middle of a lecture. I don't ever remember there being a lecture that you couldn't interrupt. And have a real give and take with somebody like Dean Labrin.
Did you take classes with him?
I did. I resisted, just the way I resisted conventional dress, I resisted anthropology and sociology. But he finally broke through my defenses and it became the greatest, and remains the greatest interest that I have in all academic subjects is now sociology, which I think should be, it isn't yet, maybe never will be, but it should be the queen of the sciences. All of the sciences, including physical sciences, should be branches of sociology if it were structured the way I think it should be.
He'd probably be delighted to hear you say that.
And of course, he was a brilliant sociologist. And I'll never forget, you mentioned veterans. I'll never forget in the spring of this class, the title of the class, I can't remember, it was in sociology. He gave a lecture on the sociology of love, including sexual love. The idea being that we were all boys, I mean, at that time. What you find alluring in a woman is socially determined to an extraordinary extent. You know, you think, you the young swain, thinks it's just this magical thing called love. And he's saying, no, it's this magical thing called society. And now there were a lot of veterans in all the classes. Many of them were older. You know, some of them had been away during the war for four years, let's say. And they were married, newly married in many cases. And they didn't like what they were hearing, that their choice of this wonderful woman had been socially determined. It wasn't something magical, unique, something that only they could feel. And so he had this wonderful Socratic dialogue in which he would say, all right, let's find out what you would not find, that you would not find acceptable as a choice in a woman to marry. And he would say, you know, physically, there are certain animals. He was now talking about the sexual physiology. They're really not that different from a human female. Now, any of those that would, of course, horrors, and that was ruled out. And then he'd go through all the possible choices. You could go to Asia, you could go to other continents all around the world. There are women all over the world, all different sorts. So he'd go through all the ethnic groups and ask for volunteers and who would like to marry, because these are all white, mostly Southerners at that time. Washington's changed a lot in that respect. And then he'd get down to body types. He said, you know, there are lots of women in their late teens, early 20s who weigh in excess of 280 pounds. And then it was a wonderful performance in which, and by the end of the class, no one could, just as it was very hard to argue with Socrates after he led you down the path of questions, it was very hard to argue with his contention that an extraordinary amount of one's choices and love were socially determined. Anyway, by the time I got to graduate school in American Studies, which is a lot closer to sociology than what I had majored in at WNL, which is English, I really found this the great subject to get into. The other was probably the teacher who had the greatest effect on my future was Marshall Fishwick. Are you familiar with Marshall?
I know the book he did on Michael Miley.
On Michael?
Michael Miley, the photographer.
Oh, I don't know that book. He's written so many, you know.
Yeah, he did a book on Michael Miley, who took photographs in during Lee's time and up to, he died in 1918. Oh, that's...
Well, Marshall had just come from, he was incidentally still teaching at Virginia Tech in the Department of Communications. had just come from Yale in American Studies, and he created a course, a year-long course, which I think I took in my junior year. I think it was certainly no sooner than that, because it was an elective course. It was essentially the American Studies condensed into a year-long course, and a lot of it was intellectual history. It would be just a couple of weeks in each of these sectors. For example, American historiography, in which for the first time I learned that there were different theories of history, that historians brought different theories to the study of history, and this had determined to a very large extent how these histories came out. For example, the Turner thesis of the settlement of the American West, or Charles and Mary Beard's economic interpretation of American history, Charles Wharton Baker's kind of sociological interpretation of the founding fathers of Virginia. And then he had a week or 2 weeks about American psychology. William James and other American psychologists. And in the course of this, he would always compare this to what had gone on in Europe. And so you would learn about Freudianism, Adlerianism, Jung's approach, and Kraft, Ebbing, and all of these currents in contemporary psychological, psychoanalytical thought. There was a couple of weeks about American art and architecture, in which you didn't just study buildings, but you studied influences, the international style, neoclassicism, which Washington Lee Campus abounds in. Mm-hmm. And you learn that, contrary to what you might think today, when that looks so traditional, that was very avant-garde, that those columns, all that, the Greek Revival, was modern at the time Washington Lee Campus was developed. I'm trying to think some of the other areas that we studied. Anthropology, Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead. And as I say, a great part of this was intellectual history, which I think is the most neglected part of the history of this country. And it's so important, in my humble opinion. This course so impressed me. He was such a magnetic teacher. I've never had a more magnetic teacher anywhere, that I decided in my senior year that I would try to follow in his footsteps and get into the Yale American Studies program. But I wonder, really, if there's ever been a greater teacher anywhere than Marshall Fishwick. I've seen him in action fairly recently at Virginia Tech. He's not only brilliant, and not only does he have this just extraordinary storehouse of just knowledge, he just seems to, he's one of these historical minds that just retains everything, but he has enthusiasm of a sort that you cannot resist. He has a glittering eye, like the Ancient Mariner, but he's not wailing. And you look at, you just have those eyes look at you in that enthusiasm, and I've never seen anything like it. Anyway, I decided on the strength of that course that that's what I wanted to do. And I always wanted to write, but I figured this would be a good background for that, and I would also could go into teaching the way he had.
You need to turn the tape on. Yeah.